Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with James Monet on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College soon as part of First Nations Comedy Experience. Jessica Greenwell speaks with author Larry Burns about his recent book, 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die. We're going to start with Rick Duloc in conversation with Ransom Wilson, artistic director and conductor for the Redlands Symphony Orchestra, and their next performance coming up March 3rd.
Ransom Wilson's long and varied career has seen him as an international flute virtuoso and recording artist, celebrated chamber musician, and now a busy conductor. He was officially announced as the Redlands Symphony's new music director and conductor on June 4th of 2016. Maestro Ransom Wilson, thank you for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
In March, you have a world premiere. Tell us about that.
Yes, Lowell Schifrin, one of the most famous composers in the world, most famous for his Mission Impossible theme, although that's only one of hundreds of things that he wrote that are memorable. He has written a tuba concerto that has never been performed before. So we got the principal tuba from the Chicago Symphony to come and play it with us, Eugene Picorni, who happens also to be a University of Redlands alumnus.
Interesting.
He's coming in, and of course, he's one of the greatest tuba players in the world. The piece is nothing like Mission Impossible. It's really a neoclassical piece. It sounds a lot like Bach in places, which is not something that you would associate with the composer of Mission Impossible. But that's what he's done, so I assembled a program around it that's largely 18th century, so that we can hear it in the context of the music that he was emulating.
That sounds interesting, and again, with an alumnus from the University of Redlands.
He's the principal tubist of the Chicago Symphony, okay. And he's coming in as a soloist just to play with us on this one concert. So, of course, we're thrilled about that.
You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm Rick Duloc, speaking today with Maestro Ransom Wilson, music director and conductor for the Redlands Symphony. We're talking about the 2017-2018 season. We're through March, we're now to April. On April 14th, you have something with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center.
That's right. We have, for the first time, I think first time anyone in the Inland Empire has collaborated on a commission with Lincoln Center. And I'm an artist of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, and I started in motion a commission of a new chamber work by John Luther Adams, who won the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago for a huge orchestral work. And this is only for about 7 instruments, but it's all about the desert. The thing about John's music is that without saying a word, he makes you think about nature and the environment. It's a remarkable thing that happens. His music moves very, very slowly, kind of at the pace of nature itself. It leaves you feeling changed in some way. So I am thrilled that we were able to be a member of this consortium that's commissioning this work from John. So there are 5 partners in the consortium, and Redlands Symphony is one of them. So I'm very proud that this has happened. And I built a concert around it that involves several different elements. The University of Redlands has a composer in residence every 2 years that comes in from the outside. And this time it's Christopher Theophanidis, who happens to be a colleague of mine at Yale University where I teach. He is coming in to spend several weeks working with the students. And it just so happened that we were able to get one of his small pieces on the same concert. Again, a piece that I premiered in New York. Was written for the Lar Lubavitch Dance Company. It's called Artemis. It was extracted from a much larger piece that was actually premiered in Greece. The composer is, in fact, of Greek extraction, so it was all a very close thing for him. The piece is very exciting and very approachable, even on first hearing. And then we're ending that concert with maybe the most famous piece of American music ever, Appalachian Spring, by Aaron Copland. Many people don't realize that the version that is best known for full orchestra was not the original version. It was written for the Martha Graham Dance Company. She had a whole series of commissions of pieces for what she called pocket orchestra. So this is only for 13 instruments. It is the Appalachian Spring that we know and love, but it's orchestrated for only 13 players. So everybody's very busy because it's a lot of music and a lot of notes in the piece. But all the musicians that I know prefer this smaller version because you can really hear what's going on.
It's less crowded.
Exactly.
Well, the 2017-2018 season concludes on Saturday, May 19th, with an evening of French masterpieces.
Yes, and this program was actually built around the fact that our friend and colleague Frederick Swan, who is one of the most famous organists in the world, has ended his teaching career at the University of Redlands, and he had decided he wasn't going to play another note. And we convinced him to come back to do one more performance of the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony. So that was the first thing that I put on the program because I knew that we wanted to work with Fred Swan. And we're thrilled because when I first moved to New York in the 70s, he was the only organist that people talked about. He was so famous. And still in the organ world, he's a legend. We're incredibly fortunate to be able to do this. His final performance, I hesitate to call it his swan song. But there are a lot of swans on this program because we're also doing the Swan by Saint-Saëns from the Carnival of Animals, the famous cello solo, maybe the most famous cello solo in the world, with our principal cellist, Kyle Champion. And we've got The Sorcerer's Apprentice of Disney fame, a work by Cécile Chaminade, a female composer from France in the 19th century, at a time when it was very hard for a woman to be taken seriously as a composer. She was really good, and this will let everybody know just how good she was. It's extracted from one of her ballets.
And so that's the big season ender. Again, that's on May 19th, and that's a Saturday. Subscription information for the Redlands Symphony is available at redlandssymphony.com. And here's the box office number. It's 909-587-5565. That's 909-587-5565. I'm Rick Dulock. You're listening to KVC Arts. My guest, Maestro Ransom Wilson, music director and conductor for the Redlands Symphony. Maestro Wilson, I saw something in the materials that I was going over before this interview that you at least had worked with the Idlewild Arts Academy Orchestra. Is that something that's ongoing as well?
No, I did that for 10 years, and it was one of my favorite things I've ever done. It was the other time in my life when I was bicoastal, because I was already teaching at Yale and came out to Idlewild about once a month. And what a beautiful place to come. It's one of the few places in Southern California that actually has weather.
And so because it's in the mountains.
I would come out in February and there would be 3 feet of snow, which is just not what you expect when 40 minutes away it's palm trees waving over the desert. It was really fun for me, and I'm happy to say that it's a high school for the arts.
Sure.
A lot of my students in the orchestra there are now famous, and they're in orchestras all over the world. So it was a good thing. It was a really good thing. And of course, I'm still friendly with all kinds of people up in Idlewild, and it is a nice place to go. When it just gets too hot in the desert, it's always cooler up there.
Just head up the hill to Idlewild in the mountains. Yeah, it's really beautiful up there.
Exactly.
Once again, my guest has been Ransom Wilson, maestro and music director for the Redlands Symphony. Thank you so much, Mr. Wilson, for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Once again, information on tickets and subscriptions to the Redlands Symphony can be found on their website, redlandssymphony.com, or with a phone call to the box office at 909-587-5565.
That was Rick Dulock in conversation with Ransom Wilson, Artistic Director and Conductor for the Redlands Symphony Orchestra. Their next concert is March 3rd, redlandssymphony.com for more information. You're with 91.9 KVCR. As KVC Arts continues, we have conversation with author Larry Burns in a book called 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die. We'll also hear from James Monet, one of the many comedians performing in the auditorium on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College soon as part of First Nations Comedy Experience. Listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear from comedian James Monet, appearing soon as part of First Nations Comedy Experience. First, though, we have Jessica Greenwell checking out things to do in Riverside before you die, in conversation with author Larry Burns in a book called 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die.
I was really proud to see Riverside Art Museum was on the cover of the book. And I didn't have a decision on what went on the cover, but I was really crossing my fingers when I submitted the photos for the publisher that they would put that on the cover, and they did, because I think it's an iconic shot. It really captures the spirit and vibrancy of Riverside. It's just this bright, colored Riverside Art Museum display that you recognize immediately. You know you're downtown when you see that. One of the beautiful things about Riverside is that commitment to the arts, and that's featured in Arts Walk.
Right.
And Arts Walk has been going on for, gosh, a decade and a half, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
But it's grown by leaps and bounds. And the reason why it's grown is because more and more studios are opening their doors, and more studios are just being created in spaces that you wouldn't normally think of. The great thing about Arts Walk is you can see all of the museums that are typically downtown. They're open their doors. They're free of charge. But the other neat feature is all of these little hidden alleys and doors. You see some doors between these bars and you wonder, where the heck does that go? And in Arts Walk, the doors open and you walk upstairs and there's a gallery there and there's guys doing artwork and there's gals doing sculptures and they're letting kids do art.
The Life
and
Art Center.
Yeah, the Life Arts Center. You can just wander around. Yeah, and Cosme stuff.
Friendly.
Yeah, Division 9 is just an amazing place, again, where you can learn the craft as well as participate and buy the art as well. And on Arts Walk, you can buy some very affordable art. Over the years, I've spent hundreds of dollars on many different pieces, but I'm spending like anywhere from $5 to $25 on pieces. And I'm not buying them to be a collector. I'm buying them because they speak to me and they're interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that as a low-cost arts collector. You don't have to have a big billfold to make that happen.
And all different types of art. I mean,
all different types.
It's amazing when you walk down there to see. You've got your sculptors and painters, but a lot of different found items and very unique items.
There's no one particular movement that's really going to identify with Riverside particular. There's a lot of different art scenes happening. One of the really interesting things that's happened over the last couple of years is these spaces that aren't art studios are becoming art studios. There's this shared workspace called Mind and Mill. This is on the corner of 6th and Main Street, and it's right by the Eliza Tibbetts statue.
Okay.
It's catty corner to the Mission Inn Hotel and Spa, and it's run by a couple of brothers, Luke and Tim, started this, and it's a shared workspace where people can come work. But more than that, it became an art studio. So there's gallery openings. They do moving displays. They have activities going on just about every single week. So even if you're not there to work, you can just go there, enjoy the art. You can purchase art there. It's a really neat feature of the community. And then directly across from it, you can see it from the exit, is T. Elliott Design Studios,
mm-hmm.
opened up a little shotgun gallery in between a couple of other retail outlets. And so every month they've got a new curated exhibition. Sometimes they have two artists working there at the same time. And that's a phenomenal little space to check out. And it's fun for younger people as well because it can really expose them to various art forms. And it's very inviting. It's a very welcoming space. And I think that's one of the things Riverside does well is they open the doors and make people realize, this is my community. These are my studios. These are my museums. And I belong here. It's not imposing. You don't feel like you're not smart enough or you don't have the right education. This is art that anybody can access, art that many of us can learn how to do ourselves. And so I've jumped right in with both feet as well. And wherever you go, whether it's Division 9 Gallery, or even like Urge Palette. Urge Palette did a great thing. They're over on 9th and Main by the Culver Arts Center. And okay. what they recently opened up was a Payne Sugar Gallery. It's called the Payne Sugar Gallery. And it's a new art space that they opened up right next to this art studio. And it makes a lot of sense because artists gravitate to Urge Palette. They go there for advice. They go there to talk. They go there just to meet other artists. And the people who run that, Fritz and Pavel, are just phenomenal people. Mm-hmm. They're the ones behind, years ago, we had a place called Blood Orange Info Shop.
Right.
Yes. Okay. That was one of the things I wanted to put in the book. And as I was doing the finishing touches, I went, oh, I should go check out and see what's new down in Blood Orange. And I go down there and it's gone.
Hmm.
And it was now Encore High School location, which is a good find. But we lost that space where young adults would go to play and learn art and express themselves. And that really came to fruition, is alive again at Urge Palette and their Payne Sugar Gallery, which is a lot of fun to see.
Yeah, that's so cool. I just love the local pride with everything that's kind of the running thread through all of this, whether it's eating establishments with their farm to table or artists welcome in. Hey, come down, check it out. And you mentioned at the beginning, you know, just go speak to somebody from the community, ask them a question, what's new, what's going on. And people are super friendly.
And that's how I did a lot of the research. I could do a lot of stuff online, but basically when I went to spaces, my thought was, okay, I'm going to go here. People like this space. They might know about other cool places that I'm not aware of. Because
right.
one of the things I wanted to avoid was, let's make this Larry's list of cool things to do. That would be interesting to Larry. What I wanted to do is really celebrate the diverse heritage and history of this community. And so by going to places, asking other people what's cool to do, what's fun to do, what are things people don't know about.
Like?
What do you like to do? This was fun. You know,
where do you go on the weekend?
Yeah. Where do you, you know, and that was particularly helpful with some of the hikes, going to a hiking location and then asking them where else to go. You know, folks at Sycamore Canyon are constantly coming and going. And you could go to Sycamore Canyon a dozen times and have a different hike every single time, depending upon what entry point you use. Same with Box Springs. It's never the same thing. If you want diversity and variations to your walks and hikes and experiences, you can get that in Riverside. You can do different things every day of the year.
I was going to mention that. I wanted to bring up so many places to bike, to hike, to run. I mean, Riverside is a super active community. Of course, a lot of people will know Mount Rubidoux. That one stands out. That's popular. Sycamore Canyon. You know, biking along Victoria Avenue, along the Santa Ana River Trail is great. But one little hike that jumped out at me that I was not aware of, Graffiti Falls. So what's that?
Graffiti Falls is this really interesting thing that's just on the outskirts of Riverside. So I used some liberties when I was talking about 100 things to
that's
do in
okay.
Riverside. I considered, you know, anywhere we had influence could be considered part of Riverside. And that's, I think that's appropriate. So Graffiti Falls is a place that is located in the middle of a residential area, essentially. So it's on the outskirts of town near where Victoria Avenue ends out towards Indiana, near the border to Corona and Riverside. Yes. Lincoln and Main off of the 91 freeway is one of the ways to get there. And I am grateful that I did some on-site checking of that location when I wrote the book, because you can take the words of other people who tell you where these cool hikes are, but once you go there yourself, and I made the, well, I don't know if it's a mistake, but I went there during a rainstorm and I took the directions, and one piece of advice, cut to the chase here, if you go to Graffiti Falls, keep the river on your left at all times. If the river ends up on your right, you're on the wrong side of it. So I spent 45 minutes finding Graffiti Falls. Yeah, so I saved everybody the time and space, ruined a pair of shoes in the process, but I eventually found it, and maybe that made it a richer experience. And why I really love that hike now is because I know what it's like to walk an hour around it. And it's really a 15-minute hike as well to get there. It's well marked with a little bit of graffiti along the way. You essentially park in a neighborhood, so you got to be mindful of the neighbors and be respectful and quiet and don't leave any trash. And you quietly walk along between the houses. Quick, you're into an open fields in the back of the area, so you've got some residential areas around you. But once you're inside the space, you really can't see too many of the houses, so it really is an isolated experience, similar to being in Sycamore Canyon or Box Springs, where you go over a hill or down a hill, and you're in wilderness.
Yeah, exactly.
You're completely removed from it. And then you come across this space. It's really inspiring the first time you see it. You come around a corner, and then there's just maybe 100, 150 feet of cliff just covered in graffiti. Now, the mystery to me is I've been there four or five times. It's always different. There's always new art. I've never seen a person actually doing the art. So,
and how do they scale up that?
I am perplexed by that. I'm always perplexed by graffiti artists everywhere. And it's great to have a space where I'm not sure on the legalities of it, but it's accepted and it's part of our cultural heritage.
Yeah,
it's left alone. And like I said, that's another place where I can go back to it every couple of months and there's going to be new art.
I'll be checking that out soon. I'm
yes.
excited.
And I suppose you can do it yourself if you wanted to as well. And the falls, depending upon the time of year, are running really heavy or really light. But there's every time I've been there, there's always been a little bit of water.
Maybe after a rain?
Yes. Go after a rain.
Running creek, perhaps?
Yeah. Not during a rainstorm like I did. Right. Go after. It's a much better experience.
At least not
experience.
On your first time.
No.
So there's another one I wanted to ask you. I'm not sure if you know, but Box Springs Mountain, of course. We know on the Moreno Valley side, they have the M. On the Riverside side, we've got the C. What is the C? I've always wondered what the C stood for.
The C stands for UC Riverside.
Okay.
It was put there, I want to say, about 50 years ago, maybe not quite that long ago, but it was put there by some college students. I believe it was a prank from some college seniors. And if you've ever been up there, the last quarter mile of that is very steep.
Right.
So when you're up there, you really are inspired and impressed with this group of college students.
How they got it up there.
Yeah,
how they
because
put it
they
together.
Had to, somebody had to lug those 50-pound bags of cement up there and organize all that. And just walking up there as a normal human being in decent health was difficult. I couldn't imagine taking a couple of cement bags with me. But they do that. And so that's been done by the students at UC Riverside. And it's been kept up over the years. They paint it every couple of years. Another interesting thing they do, which just happened last month, is they cover it up from time to time. And the funny thing is it takes days for people to notice. So
I don't think I've ever noticed.
Back in November, it was covered up for a good 5 days. And
what?
There was a few. Yeah. And just it was like, and who's going to pick up a giant C made of
that
cement?
That would have made me sad if I noticed and thought, oh, they finally got rid of it. Why?
Yeah, it's amazing because I guess it's just part of the background. You don't notice when it's gone. And so the game was for several days in November, just when are they going to notice it? Who's going to report this in the Press Enterprise? And, and so when it finally happened, we're like, oh, good, it happened today. And,
nice.
And then I'm not sure who was responsible for that, but that happens every couple of years as well.
Oh, that's some pretty neat history. I wasn't sure if you would have an answer, but you had more than I was expecting. That was really cool.
Yes.
So for many people, residents and tourists alike, one major draw to the city is its captivating history and remarkable architecture that accompanies it. So what are some of those spaces that really stand out to you?
I would say when I was looking at architecture, I didn't spend a lot of time on architecture. There was a great book put out, I want to say in 2016, about the architecture of Riverside, but it was done through the city and it's a beautiful book and I didn't want to try to compete with that.
Right.
But what I did find was just the history of some of the architecture and just how influential the Mission Inn was, and Frank Miller and his architects really designed a number of buildings in the area, and that Spanish colonial revival style is just a part of Riverside.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we've moved on from that and we have some other features as well, but it's an important part of our historical landscape. So if you're at the Mission Inn and you look around, like there's a dance hall called Aurora Vista.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a place during World War II where they housed military members. They had actually some surveillance work going on there. Not surveillance in the city of Riverside, but surveillance as part of the war theater. So they had troops there. The Riverside Municipal Auditorium is a memorial to the veterans of World War I who died from Riverside County that was built to honor them. So not only is that a place where you can enjoy great music and great cultural experiences, if you stand out in front of the building, you can see some of the plaques and you can begin to observe some of the features in the architecture that really speak to the military history of Riverside. And that's really where I focused my parts of the book, is what parts of the architecture really spoke to our military history.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, me either. I'd known a few things over the years, traveling around Riverside, but just the scale of it, just how engaged this community was and just how much we were shaped by having March Base nearby as part of our community. You know, the early members of the Chambers of Commerce, one of the first things they did was buy land and entice the military to build a base there before there was an Air Force, I believe. So really forward-thinking, and in the long term, it really did mold and shape who we are today as a community. And now we've got places like the Riverside National Cemetery, which is another important landmark and something that, the community members preserved and sustained. And to this day, there's so many unique things you can do even in the National Cemetery that you can't do at any other place in the world. There's an open-air concert that takes place, the Concert for Heroes, on July 3rd every single year. It's got a number of war memorials, a Medal of Honor, got plans for other memorials. And over the next decade, that's going to be a place to not only go visit and honor our veterans and our heroes and to see our relatives who are buried there and things like that, but that can be just a place that we can go and celebrate the cultural history of not only Riverside, but our entire United States.
Absolutely. And it's keeping the residents here that are already here in a way, because we love our city. It's, enticing people to come and visit and perhaps to, transplant themselves. I think too, just even, you know, 15 years ago, is it longer than that now, when they renovated the Mission Inn?
Yes.
I mean, and then, you know, a few years later doing the Fox, I can't imagine where the city would be now as it's expanding and growing with all the new exciting things coming up if that hadn't been done. I mean, that really is the anchor. But then hearing the history, there is so much more. I mean, the groundwork was laid with the founding, like you said, acquiring this land and developing these urban spaces, because a lot of people do know Riverside for the Mission Inn.
Yes.
Or maybe for Mount Rubidoux, because they see it when they drive by. But until you actually become a part of the community and do the research like you've done, you may not know that these other places exist and really how rich the history and culture is.
That was Jessica Greenwell in conversation with Larry Burns, author of 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Rounding out the show tonight, we have once again Emmanuel Rogers and more on First Nations comedy experience.
Joining us today is comedian James Manet. James will be one of the many great comedians, and he is seriously funny, appearing in the FNX comedy experience here in San Bernardino. Thank you, James, for taking time out to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for pulling me away from the beaches of Hawaii.
Oh.
Paradise, to come onto this radio station and speak with you.
You're welcome, and I don't feel bad at all because, well, I'm in California, so I have beaches too, but not like yours. So I'm feeling kind of down again. All right, James.
That's what we do. We try to bring Californians down. Double entendre.
Thank you. You're doing a great job. I don't know if I can continue with the interview, but I'm going to soldier on because I've seen you in some of the shows and I've seen you in some podcasts and whatnot, and I look out the windows and Hawaii is just all over the place behind you. And wow, it looks great. How is it?
Hawaii itself? I mean, it's beautiful. It's like anything else. From far away, it looks great.
Uh-huh.
But when you're in it, it looks amazing.
Wow. Yeah. Not many things actually make it to that part. Usually it looks great from a distance and then, oh, okay, I'm going back to where I came from. The desert was better. But James, I'm going to have to ask you something here. What attracted you to doing comedy?
It's weird because, you know, that question, I mean, I have to go real deep, like back to my roots.
All right.
It's just, I grew up, my sisters are, one is 10 years older, one is 5 years older, and they watch comedy. As I was growing up, I had no control of the TV, being the youngest, and they were into, like, Benny Hill.
Oh, okay.
My parents were into, like, Bob Hope. My other sister was listening to, like, Richard Pryor. So I got to see, you know, of course, without our parents knowing.
Right, right.
Variety of stand-up comedy. There's one here in Hawaii. The very first time I saw a stand-up comedian, his name is Andy Bumatai, who was part of the 80s big boom in California or in the States. And I was hooked ever since. I mean, as a fan, never thought of doing it, but being Samoan, or I guess Polynesian, because Hawaii is like this as well as like Tonga, where when we have guests, we go way out of our way to entertain our guests. And I guess it's kind of like the Southern hospitality that people talk about with the South, the Deep South in America. But it's like that here as well. If you come down, we will do our best to try to entertain you, make sure you're having a good time. And when we have visitors come over to our house, our whole house just, and it's not like we stand up and sing or anything like that.
Right.
But we make sure you're taken care of, and then we even make fun of each other to try to get you to laugh. You know, my parents will trash talk me and my sisters and my brother, and me and my siblings will go at it with each other just to make sure that the person who's there is entertained. So, and it's funny, when I'm on stage, I feel that. Like, I need to make sure these people here watching having a good time.
Well, from what I've seen, you're doing a good job.
Thanks.
You're welcome, because I understand that you drove bus at one time.
Oh, yeah. The city bus here in Honolulu for about 17 years.
Oh, wow. And so that was an experience for you.
That was a very unique experience for myself, in that I got to see, going through Chinatown, our downtown business district in Honolulu, at like 4 in the morning, and seeing it change from every hour. Is 4 in the morning, you have the people from the bars or clubs leaving.
Right, right.
Drunk. And then 5 in the morning, you get the crackheads, you know, creeping and crawling around. Then 6 in the morning, you have the business people coming into town. And just a lot of my comedy came from people watching. And driving the city bus helped develop that. And it got to a point when I started doing stand-up comedy in like my 12th or 13th year at the City Bus. I would practice as people would get on the bus in my head now, not to them.
Oh, okay.
I would pretend that they were heckling me, and in my head, I'm talking trash to everybody that came on the bus. It can be your old woman or old man walking in or a young kid. In my head, it was not happy thoughts coming out, but that's how I developed my voice when I'm not on stage.
Right.
As I went forward with the stand-up comedy. So I'm not saying I want hecklers at my show, but I usually can handle hecklers. Maybe I shouldn't say that on the air because people are going to show up and start talking to me.
Yeah, you're going to have some visitors.
Yeah, I'm not at the Chappelle level
right.
where he can get hecklers kicked out. I'm at that level where, well, they paid their money to watch the show. Right. I got to do my best and just soldier on.
Okay. No, I really have to go back to something that you and I were speaking about before we started the interview, and that's being the first Samoan comic stand-up. Is that real? Is that you?
As far as I know, it's going to be on American television.
Uh-huh.
As far as I know, yes. You know, YouTube is hard because everybody's on YouTube. I only know of one other stand-up comedian that's Samoan, and he lives in Portland, Oregon. And we both know each other. He has roots here in Hawaii. So we've met when he came through. And we refer to each other as the other Samoan comedian.
Right.
I haven't spoken to him in a while. I haven't seen him on American TV. So, you know, unless The Rock starts doing stand-up comedy, which I heard is something that might happen, then FNX Comedy Experience, I would be the first.
All right. But now, I didn't know Dwayne Johnson was Samoan.
Oh, yeah, his mother is full Samoan. His dad is African-American, both from the wrestling world.
Okay.
His dad, it's funny because I remember my mom was telling me back in her days, I guess, I don't know if it was the 60s or 70s, I'm not sure. But she said, Rocky Johnson, who's Dwayne Johnson's father, I think back then it was WWF.
Yeah.
They did a show in American Samoa, which is where my family is from. And my mom was like, oh, my goodness. And he came down. All the women were like, oh, my. Because he is huge. Like, if you think The Rock is big, his dad had more mass.
And wow.
His muscles were very defined at that time when everything was, you know, there was no supplements. Everything was natural. You worked out, and that's how you got big. So he had really good genes. His grandfather, on the mother's side, was like one of the biggest professional wrestlers ever in the Pacific. Peter Maivia, they call him the High Chief.
Wow.
So, yeah, The Rock's lineage is just amazing.
Well, thank you for taking the time with that aside. I appreciate that. Now, you have a criteria for becoming a comedian that I've never heard before, and that is to be a comedian, you must first have to be a loser. Will you explain that one for our audience?
Well, you do your research.
I try.
Okay, I didn't mean loser in the term of everybody just says that guy is nothing, he's garbage. It's a person who had to have experienced loss. It doesn't have to be traumatic, but it has to be something significant so that you know what it's like to be down there and then to come back from it and to grow from it and then talk about it.
Okay.
And then you trash talk it as well. And it's one of the best, I guess, advice I got was from Doug Stanhope, which was just get out and experience things you've never done before.
Right.
Even if you fail at it, and then get on stage and share your experience.
Oh, wow.
And if you failed at it, it's a lot funnier than if you succeeded at it.
Oh, I have to rethink my life here. Okay.
So when people aren't funny, I tell them, well, you're just successful.
Well, I'm successful.
There you go. Well, you have an amazing voice. I feel like I'm on like late night, the Love Jam show.
Thank you. Thank you. Because once I turn the mic off, it's going to be a little more, you know.
That was a successful joke.
Thank you. Thank you. I've had two. That was the second one in my life. So I'm on a roll. 20 years from now, I should have my third one.
There you go. You got a whole set.
No, I've been asked to open for a few comedians, and right now, I don't know, it's just not something I thought about. They were saying, hey, you sound like you can tell a joke or talk a lot. That part I can do.
Well,
why don't you come and open for
it? Joke telling has evolved as far as stand-up goes. It went from back in, I guess, in the 80s, it was like you tell a joke the way you set up, punch, whereas now it's getting more storytelling.
Yeah.
But if you have an amazing story, and I think podcasts and talk show radio has helped develop that, where if you're telling me a really interesting story, I'm going to listen.
Right.
And then when you throw in little puns here and there, all of a sudden it's like a comedy set.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I was enjoying some of those podcasts, like I said, that you were doing in Hawaii, and you guys were just kicking back talking to each other. But it turned out to be, you know, a lot of fun, a lot of laughter coming out of it, and it was, I really enjoyed it myself.
Oh, thanks. Our biggest fan is actually in Germany and commented saying that he really likes that. It's like guys hanging out in the locker room.
Right.
Whereas we're in Hawaii, so we're all over the place. We actually started out at a strip club.
Oh, okay.
Which was how we got people to click on our podcast. He's like, whoa, they got a porn star there? Let's see what this is. And you know, anything you can do to get those numbers up.
Right. Yeah, because that does seem to get some people's attention. I'm not going to say you got mine at all, but I just been made aware that as you will be appearing here in San Bernardino, it's on Friday the 9th, not Sunday the 11th as originally aired. The day has been changed. Now, what attracted you to come out and help with the FNX comedy experience?
Well, when Graham Elwood told me about it right off the bat, I was intrigued. I was like, that's awesome. Because I guess every group kind of has their thing that helps support their people.
Uh-huh.
There was the Latin Kings of Comedy, the Def Jam, which was predominantly black, but also had mixed, you know, there was some white people in there.
Right. I don't
think there's any Asians. I guarantee there was no Samoans. So, like, everybody has their thing to help bring it up. And when I heard about this, you know, with the First Nations, with Native Americans, I think it's great because they have a voice as well.
Right.
I mean, I remember seeing, like, I was talking about Bob Hope days. I forget the gentleman's name, but I think he's in the series from, you know, from back in the 80s. Good looking guy. Forget his name, but I think he's part of this. He's, well, he's, of course, he's much older now, but it was exciting. I was like, wow, that's great. That's good. You get the name out. You get this, all of them together. It's like a festival. You know, we celebrate that we do this as well. And for me as a Samoan, like my sister, she's been in the stage actor, and I always go to support her. And I tell her it's because although it's amazing for us to see Samoans in the NFL, in MMA, in movies, to see them doing other things like, you know, whether it's singing or dancing or other performing arts, I'm all for it, you know, because people will only know us as the last thing they saw, which majority is, you know, Junior Seau or Troy Polamalu or The Rock.
So
when they see us doing other things, I always try to go support it. And Native Americans, I think we're connected, Polynesians.
Yes.
I think we are strongly connected, you know, back before the paleface people came around.
Okay.
Sorry if I'm insulting anybody, but
right,
before
no,
the white
no,
man
no.
came around. Maybe I should say it that way.
No, no, say it any way you like. I was there.
The man. But before, you know, Captain Cook was the first one to come out here. So people have seen the Moana movies. The Polynesians, we've mapped out. I say we, like I'm included. I wouldn't be able to go out and canoe down to the next island. I'd be lost. But my ancestors already mapped out the Pacific. And if you look at the Pacific, it is huge. And these tiny little islands they could find just by, you know, looking up at the stars, reading the waves and the tide and the birds. It's silly to say that they've never made it to the giant continents. And then the things that we have in common is just like canoes. The Easter Island, which is closest to South America. It looks similar. There's the Marquesas people. They look similar to Aztec, the way they dress. And it's just very similar. And then what happened with the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy.
Right.
Where they came over and a lot of Polynesians died, or mostly Hawaiians died, because of the same sickness that killed off a lot of Native Americans.
Really?
You know, Polynesians didn't get it because there was no illnesses until Captain Cook came down and brought all these germs. And then they started to get sick. And then a lot of them died off. There's actually...
Wow.
I think there's no pure Hawaiians anymore. Because of all of the mixture that's going on. Hawaii is a true melting pot, whereas people say New York City is a melting pot. But you still have your Italian neighborhoods,
really?
Your Irish neighborhoods. In Hawaii, you go up to a Hawaiian person, you ask them, what is their ethnicity? They'll tell you, I'm Hawaiian, Chinese, Portuguese, Irish. They're mixed.
Wow.
They don't have any that says, I am only Hawaiian.
You really are helping me to understand something, because when you say Samoan, Polynesian, and then Hawaiian, I thought these were three distinct, different peoples. They're not, are they?
Well, it's like we're cousins and that we're all Polynesian.
Okay.
But Samoans are from the South Pacific, next to another group of islands, the Tongans in Tonga.
Okay.
And then Hawaiians are actually in the middle of the Pacific, above the equator, whereas everybody else is below the equator.
Oh, so it's a matter of where you are.
Well, it's kind of like the Caribbean has Puerto Ricans. They're not Dominicans. They're not Haitians.
Right.
So they're all Caribbean, but they're all different in that, you know. So it's just like that. It's like calling a Jamaican person African. You know, if you go back to the lineage, of course, yeah, but they might get insulted or offended. Or I have an ex-girlfriend who's Puerto Rican, and she used to work at TGI Fridays, and she got mad when they would assume that she knew how to make guacamole.
I'm so sorry.
And she said, I do know how to make it, but don't assume that I know how to make it. But similar in that way.
Right. Like,
Tongans and Samoans may look similar, but totally different culture. Actually, Tonga is the only one with monarchy left. Samoa is mostly the chiefs ran the islands.
Right. James, before we get too far out, because this is just a fun conversation, I would like to give you an opportunity to share with our audience what are the things that you're involved in and what you would like the public to know.
Of course, the podcast that I'm on, Guys with Issues.
Okay.
You can check it out on marscomedy.com, or you can check it on iTunes or Stitcher app. That's the Guys with Issues comedy podcast. Me, two of my best friends, Russell Kealoha and Chad Wago. Basically, we give you the news. We go over current events from a Hawaii perspective. And also, we give you what's going on in the islands as well.
Okay.
And we just trash talk all of it. Also, I played a character called Lenoy Arnold, who's on Adult Swim's Decker.
Oh, okay.
Which has a bunch of seasons out. You can check it out either on YouTube or on Adult Swim website. And something to know about myself, I guess not too much. When I get on stage, I pretty much put it out there. I talk about my daughter. I'm a proud parent. And I don't know if anybody out there listening who doesn't have kids, but that's like the biggest accomplishment I've ever had. I don't know why I'm talking about my daughter.
Yeah, no, go for it, man.
But I'm a soccer parent. I was never into soccer growing up, but now I'm a huge, I even call it football. I call NFL American football, and I call soccer football. Then my daughter's a football player, and I don't know why I'm turning into like some weird European. I guess Captain Cook eventually wins in the end or something. It converts me into red coats. I'm not sure what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's just a melting going on. It, you know, it started when he came and it's still going on.
Yeah, the sickness is still traveling through.
Well, I was trying to kind of slide away from the sickness and back to the melting, but okay, we're all going to need a prescription after this one.
The prescription is get those tickets and see you at the show March 9th.
What do you find funny? What makes you, the comedian, laugh?
It's the weirdest thing. It's like I enjoy people who play with words and write amazing jokes, performers, you know, Chris Rock, or just so quick. And I enjoy and I appreciate that from a comedian's point of view. You know, like, wow, that's amazing work.
Right.
But the thing that gets me, honestly, is being at home and just have my parents just trash talk each other.
Uh-huh.
And it could be like the silliest of things. And it's not even like no one else would laugh at it. It's just, you know, the dad humor.
Yeah.
You know, like everywhere we go, dad has his routine. Or if you go to McDonald's or something, and it's like, would you like some fries at that shake? And he just says, is it free? You know, and it's like, it's not funny.
Well,
the fact that he does it every time we go.
Right.
It just cracks me up. Or it's like, come on, write another joke, Dad.
I don't know. It hit me funny because it's like, okay, well, it sounds like you're offering me fries. Yes, I'll take them. You know, it's like, because I didn't ask for them, so there can't be a charge, right? Right? You're giving me fries. I don't know.
Yeah, that's where I get my growing up and then getting to know my parents because, you know, America, everybody has to work. So, as a kid, I hardly saw them because they were always working. I would see them at night when they would come home and scold me for whatever I did wrong. And then I find out, like, wow, this is where I get my humor from. And when I was working at the bus, my dad was a supervisor there. And there was a woman who was married like 5 times.
Right.
And she came up to me. She gave me an invitation to her wedding. She said, hey, give this to your dad. Let him know the wedding is, yada, yada, yada. So I go home and I say, hey, Dad, She said, you and mom are invited to the wedding. And he goes, oh, I'll just wait for the next one. And I told her that, and she got mad, but everybody in the break room was just rolling.
Right.
And then I see it, I was like, wow, that's where I get it from.
Yeah.
It's that little thing that gets me going.
Have you ever asked your dad to come on stage with you? I just had to ask.
No, because then I'll feel like a loser again.
Okay.
He's that old school parent, kind of like Oscar De La Hoya's dad, where you're never good enough for me, but it was the toughness, you know, that we needed at right. that age, at that time, to help us be who we are today.
All right. Well, James, now, this is going to sound strange for our audience, but you said you're from South Central L.A. Can you tell us about that one?
Okay, so technically, I'm not from California, but I live in South Central Oahu, which is the island I live on.
Right.
I live in South Central. I live in a city called Aiea in the lower part, so L.A., Lower Aiea.
Okay.
So I'm from South Central Oahu, Lower Aiea.
Okay.
I get the same street cred, though.
Yeah. Now, you've gone over where our audience can find you online and all, but I know that they can also find some of your things on YouTube. I would like to give you an opportunity, because our time is running out, to go ahead and share with our audience one more time where all the places they can find you, what you're into, and what you'd like them to know.
Okay, so I'm heavy on social media. So even if you just Google comedian James Mane, spelled M-A-N-E, like a lion's mane.
Right.
You'll find me on Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, and I'm almost always on that. So a lot of people follow me on Instagram. I do a lot of pictures and videos with my daughter, who's 14 now, and she actually wants to get into doing a YouTube channel where we will be doing sketches and vlogs, and so me, her, and my sister.
Oh, wow.
So we'll start doing sketches. So that's something that should be coming out, hopefully, if her grades are okay, probably in the summer, we'll start blasting them out.
Wow.
The name of the group is going to be Shredded Coconuts.
Right.
So be on the lookout for that. But yeah, if you find me on social media, you'll be able to see. And I think successful comedians are good at marketing. That's what I'm working with, social media.
Oh, that is so cool. Yeah, I'll be looking out for that, because I'll know whether or not your daughter's grades were up to par by whether or not she's on the show. This has been a lot of fun. A lot of fun. I want to thank you,
James. Thank you. Had a great
time. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
And thank you, Emmanuel Rogers, in conversation with James Mane, one of the many comedians performing soon on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College as part of First Nations Comedy Experience. fnx.org/comedy for more information and the upcoming lineup. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to James Mane. Thanks also to Larry Burns, author of 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die, and to Ransom Wilson, artistic director and conductor for the Redland Symphony Orchestra. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Emmanuel Rogers, Jessica Greenwell, and Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts. Behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.